From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Today, we celebrate Juneteenth.
The people of Texas are informed that, in accordance with a proclamation from the executive of the United States, all slaves are free.
The words of Union Army General Gordon Granger, first delivered on this date in 1865. Later this hour, we remember people who died in slavery and were buried in Atlanta's Oakland Cemetery. First, though, we talked last week about the city's gentrification problem.
To keep folks like myself, my children in those communities, there's got to be some type of equitable development that is going to allow for long-term residents to be transformative from rental into home ownership.
That's Allison Johnson from Peoplestown in Atlanta. Here are your first thoughts. Joel Cook asks, how much have property taxes risen? Is there an average percent, and are there some extreme examples? Well, Joel, the answer really depends on where you live. For perspective, the average property tax bill in Georgia is about $1,350 per year. The average bill in Fulton, though, is double that. That is the highest in the state. And earlier this month, the county announced those bills will go up again. The average increase is 13%. Fulton County's chief appraiser, Dwight Robinson, said in a statement, quote, we have undergone a thorough process to ensure that we're in alignment with best practices in property valuation. This year's valuations are consistent with a strong sales in neighborhoods located throughout Fulton County, end quote. Property owners who disagree with the new assessments have until July 10th to appeal. We always welcome your questions. You can call us at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Twitter, like Joel did. It's at OST Talk, or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. When you go into a hair salon or a cosmetic store, how much do you know about the products used on your skin or your hair? A recent study says there are dangerous chemicals in some of these products, especially those marketed to Black women. That study comes from the nonprofit Environmental Working Group. Earlier this year, we spoke with a panel about these risks and the history of Black hair care. Nika Leiba is Deputy Director of Research for the Environmental Working Group. Hi, Nika.
Hi.
Also with us is Alelia Bundles. She's a self-proclaimed Black hair historian, and she is also the great-great-granddaughter of Madam C.J. Walker, who was the first Black millionaireess in America and invented the world's first hair straightening formula. Alelia, thanks for joining us.
Hi, but we'll talk about, she didn't invent the hair straightening formula, but we'll talk about that.
We will get right to that in a moment. But first, I want to welcome in studio, we have Atlanta hairstylist Latasha Gray. It's good to have you as well.
Thanks. Good morning.
So she did not invent it, because she is credited with that, Alelia.
Well, you know what? There's a lot of stuff on the internet that's not correct. She did not invent the straightening comb. She did not invent the perm. She invented a hair conditioner that healed scalp disease.
And she was certainly successful at marketing all those things, whether she invented them or not.
Well, she did not market a straightener, but she marketed a shampoo and Madam Walker's Wonderful Hair Grower and other ointments that that healed scalp disease.
Okay, and it's important. I want to make sure everyone's aware, staying with me, on why this is important. Why do you make a point of saying that she did not market the hair straightening formula?
Well, because her initial problem is that she was going bald. She had really bad dandruff and scalp infections 111 years ago, when most people didn't have indoor plumbing. Hygiene was very different. People didn't wash their hair very often, and so they had really bad scalp disease. So her revolutionary system was a shampoo and an ointment that contained sulfur, something like Vaseline, that healed the dandruff and the sores on the scalp so the hair could grow. Hence, Madam Walker's Wonderful Hair Grower.
Okay, so this subject obviously has been a subject of debate, certainly among Black women for sure, for a very, very long time. How much, Latasha, do your clients ask you about, or how concerned are they over the chemicals that are in the products that are used in their hair?
I would say 3 out of 5 clients come in, and when they're trying to get their hair shampooed, they always ask, is this sulfate-free? That's really the only thing that they have a precaution about. Is it sulfate-free?
And how hard is it to find products that don't have sulfates in them?
It's not really hard. Our salon in particular offers 1 or 2 lines that that are sulfate-free, but we do definitely offer ones that do have sulfate in it. So, in my opinion, when you go to the store, there are a decent amount of options for sulfate-free products.
Okay, and that brings us to you, Nika, because the research coming out of the Environmental Working Group suggests that it can be difficult to find products that don't have chemicals that can be toxic. Can you tell me the results of your research?
Yeah, certainly. EWG has been working on cosmetics and personal care products and looking at their toxicity for years. And we know how antiquated the law is that governs personal care, meaning that companies can use almost any ingredient that they see fit in products without testing them for safety. But we wanted to look specifically at products marketed to Black women, and that report showed that of the more than 1,000 products we looked at, unfortunately, Black women who shop exclusively for products marketed to their demographic would have fewer healthier options of products to choose from.
Now, this isn't a result of your research, but did you have any idea why that is? Why are there so many more potentially toxic chemicals in products marketed to Black women?
You know, it would be speculation, and I can speculate that there are some traditional hair products that the Black community uses that have caustic ingredients like hair straighteners and some hair dyes that have hormone-disrupting chemicals. But again, we didn't look specifically at that, so it would be speculation.
Well, then let me take that to our Black hair historian, Alelia Bundles. Why do you think it has ended up this way, where there are so many potentially dangerous chemicals in products for Black women?
Well, you know, when I looked at the research, I looked at the analysis, it looks as if of the almost 1,200 products that were analyzed, hair relaxers and hair dyes and hair bleaches were included in that. And everything really sort of skews in that direction. Those are the worst offenders. It is significant that the share of the hair care market for relaxers has really gone down within the last decade. And I think that's a result of people being more conscious of it. But I would say, you know, when you look at the hair relaxers and you look at why women feel they need to straighten their hair, there is so much societal pressure and cultural pressure to do that. The Army finally lifted its ban on locks and braids. People are still being fired from their jobs if they don't straighten their hair. And so there is that kind of cultural pressure that makes people feel as if they need to use those chemical relaxers.
The documentary Good Hair from comedian Chris Rock goes into a lot of these issues that we're discussing right now. In it, a chemist is telling Chris here about the dangers of a chemical that's used in a particular relaxer.
If it gets down into the scalp, it'll kill it at the root and you'll actually have bald spots there.
So if you're a beautician or something and you deal in sodium hydroxide all day, I mean...
I wouldn't do it. If you breathe just the fumes from sodium hydroxide, those fumes will ruin your lungs. They'll damage your lungs permanently.
Latasha, how long have you been in this business?
I've been doing hair since 2007, but full-time since 2015 at a hair salon.
Have you been exposed to some chemicals that gave you concern?
No. Actually, the hair salon I worked at is a natural hair salon. That means that we do not apply relaxers. However, we do apply hair color, but not relaxers. So I feel like as a hairstylist, I have a reduced exposure.
You're not being exposed to sodium hydroxide, which is caustic.
Right.
But let's then explain what natural hair is for people who may not be of African American descent and have no idea what that is.
Right. So it's so funny. It's a two-way street. So natural sometimes can mean when you don't have a relaxer in your hair or when you're chemical free. But there are some individuals that do not put a relaxer in their hair, but they have hair color. So technically you're not chemical free. You're not natural. But natural just means that you don't put chemicals in your hair to alter your hair texture. But like I said, most people it's very rare for me to see a client that is completely natural, because even if they don't use a relaxer, they're using hair color.
We're talking about the dangers of certain cosmetic products, especially those targeted to black women. And I'm speaking with Atlanta hairstylist Latasha Gray, you just heard. Also, Nika Leiba of the Environmental Working Group and journalist and black hair historian Alelia Bundles. Nika, this particular research is not being duplicated. In fact, it's not all that easy to find this information on what is in hair products. Why is it so difficult in some cases to find out what's going on to our hair and our skin?
You know, that's a great question. And groups like Black Women for Wellness and the West Harlem Environmental Action have done some work on this issue, but it is not widely studied. I think part of the reason is because there's not a desire. You know, the consumer doesn't know yet that she needs to know this information. And so getting this information to them right now will make them more appreciative of the dangers and therefore demand more information about it. So we're hoping that this spurs more research on the topic.
Alelia, have you seen, through black hair history, have you seen a change in the trend in terms of people's awareness of what's in these products, and also what Latasha was talking about in terms of the push for natural hair?
Yes, I mean, I'm old enough to have gone through the original hair wars in the early 60s when we went from pressed hair and perms to natural hair, and I've watched the pendulum swing back and forth. It is very interesting, really, in this last sort of 5 to 7 years, where there are companies like Sundial Brands and Shea Moisture and others, black-owned companies in particular, where they are scoring well on this EWG study, with fewer high hazard, more low hazard ingredients, and I think they're very aware of offering products that are useful for African American women who have quite a few different textures of hair. We range from kinky to straight, and to have products that don't have parabens, that don't have sulfates, this is something that's very important to the consumer. But I do agree that this study is really needed to raise awareness, because I think most people don't think about it. Even if they've gone from the sodium hydroxide in the relaxers, there are still plenty of other things that are not healthy.
So, Latasha, how have you seen this trend play out in terms of what customers ask for when they come into your salon?
Okay, well, I know you've heard of YouTube, right?
No, so, what is that?
So consumers, it's so funny. They watch YouTube and then sometimes they come in the salon and they tell us, hey, what are you doing? Because I saw on YouTube that you're supposed to be doing this to my hair, or you're supposed to use this on my hair. So like I said, I think bloggers and natural hair enthusiasts that have created YouTube channels because they may have done research or whatever, they do expose clients to, hey, use this product, don't use this product, don't use sulfate, let's co-wash, don't shampoo your hair often. Like, they have these different strategies.
What is co-wash?
Co-wash is basically when you're not using shampoo to cleanse your hair, you're actually using conditioner to cleanse your hair.
Because shampoo can strip off the oils that protect your hair.
Right. As a stylist, our job is to get the hair to look the way the client wants it to look. They have a desired style in mind. And sometimes using certain products can prevent that from happening. So some of the products that may not have sulfate, or the concept of not using things that don't have chemical or highly hazardous things, sometimes those products can help you reach your goal for styling, and sometimes it prevents you from reaching.
But wait, have you had clients then come in who have damaged their hair with these products irreversibly?
Yes.
That's Atlanta hairstylist Latasha Gray. Our conversation continues in just a moment. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're talking about how hair products marketed to black women can be more toxic than average. Earlier this year, we spoke with journalist Alelia Bundles, Atlanta hairstylist Latasha Gray, and Nika Leiba of the Environmental Working Group. So let me go back to the research of the Environmental Working Group then, Nika. What else needs to be known? Because frankly, some of the blogs that you watch is based on research that is, in my view, kind of sketchy. It's not necessarily
good, solid clinical research. So what else needs to be done?
I think the consumer needs to become more educated about these ingredients. And that's something that all of us are starting to know. And luckily, we have a resource like Skin Deep. But it's not just chemical hair straighteners that have ingredients of concern. There are parabens, which are endocrine disruptors and can potentially affect fertility. You know, there are allergens. They're all ingredients linked to cancer. So becoming more aware of these chemicals that are frequently used in products that we use every single day, and then demanding that companies reformulate or take those chemicals out. What we've seen over the last few years is that consumer pressure has forced the industry to change, move towards better ingredients. And so with more education and more awareness of this issue, we're hoping that that trend continues.
And is this possibly a pendulum swing, Alelia, as you were referring to earlier? Could we be headed in the midst of a natural hair revolution at the moment, and then it'll swing back towards relaxers and straightening again?
I hope not.
No,
I hope it doesn't swing all the way back. I hope that we are, you know, we're now at a place where there's so many options for products that don't have these harmful ingredients, but that also do the trick. And there is pressure to, when people want a certain style and the hairstylist feels the pressure to conform to that. But there also are other ways. I mean, I know in our new Madam C.J. Walker Beauty Culture line, there are no silicones in our oils, but it still achieves the same result. And I think that there has to be consciousness raising. I mean, I'll just tell you quickly, I was speaking at a high school where there's a beauty course, and young women who were pregnant were using the chemical relaxers, and the teachers really tried to get them not to do that during a certain period of their pregnancy, and they just felt the pressure to want to be able to do that. But that's harmful. That's a consciousness raising. It's like getting people to stop smoking, that there are other ways that you can have other styles or achieve other looks without being harmful to yourself.
Latasha, this gets tricky, though. There are a lot of natural products. Even if you go into Walgreens now, these things that you never used to be able to find, mm-hmm. I can find my Cantu shampoo there and mm-hmm. my Miss Jessie's cream for after the shower. But this gets tricky because people are very emotional to their hair. It's not always just a logical proposition. I mean, how do you get through some of that when you're speaking to your clients?
Are you referencing...
People have emotional ties to products.
Right.
They have,
right.
And their hair becomes, it's not a logical thing anymore. That discussion about hair mm-hmm. can be very passionate.
Right.
How do you cut through that?
Honestly, when a person decides to come, I mean, you either decide to go to a salon that's for natural hair, or you can just say, hey, that's a bunch of crock. I'm not buying what they're selling. Let me go to another salon, right? So a lot of the clients that I deal with, they have made a conscious decision that, hey, I want better for my hair. Now, even with that, like I said, I still do have clients that are very attached to certain brands. And what I, as a stylist, like to do is if they are attached to a certain brand, let's reduce the amount of usage. Keep using it sparingly, because me personally, I always feel like too much of anything isn't good for you. So I don't really try to snatch away, like, you know, what they're so used to. But I say, hey, you've been using this X amount of times, let's reduce it, and then hopefully wean them off of it. But you're right, you can't. It's very hard to get a woman to not be loyal to a brand. But the best way is to wean them off of it.
That's Atlanta hairstylist Latasha Gray. We also spoke with journalist Alelia Bundles and Nika Leiba of the Environmental Working Group.
Thought I
Atlanta's Oakland Cemetery is still working to identify hundreds of unmarked graves in order to honor the lives of the African Americans buried there. Last year, groups of all ages were invited to tour the cemetery's historic grave sites. Producer Sean Powers brings us this audio postcard.
The African American Burial Ground, Burial Ground at Oakland Cemetery demonstrates racial segregation in America, in life and in death.
My name is Joshua Julius. I am 9. I'm about to turn 10 in July. It's important to remember all of them because they could have made a difference. It could have been a small difference or a big difference, but they both made up where we are now.
Earn the right to be treated equally with whites, even in death.
So see, that's very good, Joshua. Look at the pictures that are here. See, that young boy may be about your age, and he's drinking from a water fountain. And what does this say?
Colored.
Yeah. I'm D.L. Henderson, and I'm a volunteer and board member with the Historic Oakland Foundation. Okay, keep looking. Let's see. What do we have here? Can you read that marker? And the kids have a cultural treasure hunt that they're following to look at, to find out all about the historic treasures that are here in the cemetery. Okay, now look at the second question. What's the second question?
Says most African Americans living in Atlanta were enslaved before the Civil War. Find the grave of someone who was born during slavery before 1866.
Right. So before this, many of the graves, if you look all around you, you won't see marked graves, but there will be people who are buried there. We recently did a study with ground penetrating radar. Right? And they sort of took a camera, basically, rolled it over the ground, and that's what showed up on the film, those where we have those orange markers. Yeah. So that showed probable grave sites. So we may already have most of this. There were 872 probable grave sites listed here that we see with the orange markers. But keep in mind that over 12,000 African Americans have been buried at Oakland since its founding.
My name is Tamia Lewis. I'm here with my daughter, Anaya Lewis. She's 7. I want her to learn about African-American history, learn where our ancestors come from. She's just getting to the age where I feel comfortable introducing her to things and teaching her about, you know, American history, slavery, and things of those nature.
It's pretty sad that people were slaves.
I don't think she can fully grasp it quite yet, but she's slowly learning how serious and how important it is.
You guys want to walk around some more? Or are you ready to go back up? You've been down here a while. You've been down here a couple of hours. So good work. So turn your cultural treasure hunt in back at the table up there, and they'll give you a little keepsake to take with you to remember
your
day. Thank you for participating in our hunt.
An audio postcard from producer Sean Powers. Now let's add 2 more songs to our Georgia playlist. That's where we ask people to choose the best songs from and about Georgia. And the rules are very simple. All tunes have to be written or performed by a Georgian, and musicians cannot pick one of their own songs. Today we bring a series of songs that are chosen by musicians performing at Athfest this weekend. Mike Mantioni is frontman for Athens band 5-8, and here are Mike's picks.
My name is Mike Mantioni, and I play in the band 5-8 from Athens, Georgia. My first pick is the band The Glands and the song Straight Down. The Glands came up a little after 5-8, but when I heard The Glands play, I knew where I wanted to go, and I had missed it. The just effortless play on words and the way he sang, like he was telling you a story, and it was so beautiful, and the band rocked like maybe the Velvet Underground with the Rolling Stones put together with a really bad stapler, maybe. It's just that vision of the way you live when you're down and out, when you just, you're living just for the moment. And he's listing thing after thing, the lady with the poodle, just these nutty visions that you have of things, and they just stick in your head and you're like, what? But you know, he's just basically walking down the street and it's rock and roll. And that's what I get from it. Lady with the poodle. You, it's in a bad way. You know, the guitars have this incredible, an incredible tremolo that he just clicks in this one spot. And it's just like, right when they hit the note, it's like, like that. And it's just like, there's a low bass, but it's not so sonically low that it's under the register. You know, it's very organically recorded. It sounds like you're right in the room with them in the band. The snare is there, the kick is there. There's a little bit of cymbal, but nothing's overwhelming. The vocals are reed thin, but they cut through. It's almost like he's whispering to you. The guitars are like razor blades, but they're not overpowering. Nothing comes through the mix and makes your ears bleed. But you wind up having to turn it up and turn it up. And by the time you're done turning it up, you are just rocking down the highway. I mean, just an incredible rock band on Capricorn, and just a lot of great stuff to say about them. So my second pick for the Georgia Music Playlist is Vic Chestnut's song, Speed Racer. Now this song is a very intense song. When I first got to Athens back in 88, I saw Vic play at the old 40 Watt, and it changed everything about my songwriting. He was a poet. He strung words together that you would never expect to hear together. A turn of phrase that was very conversational. The words that he put in were not the conversation you were expecting to have.
If I learned anything from all of these lectures, I think it's my attention span eclipsed by TV at an early age.
Speed Racer is an intensely personal song, and it's a song that basically says, I'm an atheist. And it's almost like an anthem for atheists, but it's an anti-anthem. It's like no other anthem you've ever heard.
I used to watch Speed Racer. We had that hyper attitude that carried me here to this fluorescent enlightenment. I'm not a victim. I'm not a victim.
And he tells about Speed Racer, the TV show, which I loved as a kid, and me and Vic were around the same age. Vic does this thing with this song that no other artist could ever do, and paint this picture of a little boy, neurotic, hyperactive, who grows up to be a man who doesn't believe in God. And there's no other person on this earth that could do that. Take a tender young boy and then come up with this, like, I'm an atheist, I'm not a victim. And you have to understand, he's singing, I'm not a victim, and he's sitting in a wheelchair, and he's like, you know, just like, it's just unbelievable.
The laws of action and reaction are the closest thing to truth in the universe.
It's just him and an acoustic guitar and this really weird, almost synthesizer-sounding guitar solo thing that kind of runs throughout the song. It's like you're sitting in the room except for this crazy guitar thing that's just like, and it's just like a cat kind of scratching along the back. So imagine Vic in a wheelchair with his pick almost taped to his thumb, strumming on a nylon string classical guitar. You can hear the wood of the guitar. You can hear his hand hit it in his idiosyncratic playing with his idiosyncratic time signature and this driven kind of weird noodling sound in the background, just, and then his voice just bringing you through this story.
That's Mike Mantione of the Athens band 5/8. They perform at Athfest on the Hull Street stage this Sunday at 6:30 p.m. And if you have a song that you want to add to the playlist, we want to hear about it. Call us at 404-500-9457 or tweet at OST Talk to nominate a tune. You can find the entire Georgia Playlist series along with all the great music segments we've done at gpbnews.org. Just ahead, a drug overdose crisis in Middle Georgia raises some tough questions. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. Tomorrow, we'll talk about heroes. Last month, two men in Portland were killed after standing up for women who were being harassed on a train. So what makes a hero? And who would you call a hero in your personal life or even in public life? Who would you say deserves that title? Call and leave us a message at 404-500-9457, and then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for that conversation. Middle Georgia suffered a spate of drug overdoses this month. In less than a week's time, 19 people were hospitalized with similar symptoms. 30 cases have been reported. 5 people have died. Join me to talk about this is Chris Hendry, Chief Medical Officer of Navisant Health. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning.
Also with me is Shannon Gordon, CEO of River Edge Behavioral Health Center in Macon. Hi, Shannon.
Hello.
And by Skype, we have writer and neuroscientist Mark Lewis. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
So, Chris, what was the cause of these overdoses? And by that, I mean we have been suffering through an opioid addiction epidemic for a number of years. But why this particularly severe number of cases?
Well, it appears that there was a new compounded tablet that was being sold on the street as Percocet. And in reality, it looks like from the GBI analysis of the chemicals, it was actually a compound that was similar to fentanyl and another compound that's on the street known as pink. So neither of the drugs inside of the tablet that people were purchasing as Percocet were actually Percocet. And the drugs are extremely potent, which accounted for the number of overdoses we saw in such a short period of time.
Mark, what makes fentanyl so dangerous?
Well, as Chris said, it's very potent. It's a 2 milligram quantity is enough to kill somebody. And there's a whole lot of analogs of similar drugs, some of which are 10 or 100 times more powerful. And these drugs seem to be quite cheap to manufacture, so they're just popping out on the street all over the place, sometimes mixed with heroin, sometimes in pill form, and the buyers never know what they're getting.
Now, Shannon, we have had a lot of discussion nationwide about the overprescription of painkillers. But in many cases, and I think it looks like this case, these are things that people bought on the street. Is this something that you find is common?
Yes. At some point, people do move to the street to satisfy their desire for chemicals.
How? Give me an idea of that sort of common timeline of someone who becomes addicted and how they end up buying pills that may be dangerous on the street.
Well, every person is an individual, and so the timeline is not static. I've not known someone ever in my history of treatment to want to start and end up in addiction. People begin to manage pain, or they begin to see what it's like, and then the drug begins to take its hold.
So here's a comment from Bibb County Sheriff David Davis. He was speaking at a press conference just a few weeks back.
I would invite anyone who has a drug problem or who takes illegal drugs and is worried right now that they may face some legal repercussions, we're going to let that pass. We need to know who's putting this poison in the community right now.
Chris, how do you know when your addiction, when you are addicted, I should say, or when your use of painkillers is dangerous?
Well, like Shannon said, most of the time these people start off because they've got some type of pain they need to control, whether it's some post-operative pain or an injury or what have you. And it's insidious. It's not like one day you're taking your pain medication and the next you're addicted and are engaging in risky behaviors. But if you're starting to miss work, if you're buying, you know, unable to get the drugs from your physician, you're looking at asking your friends, you're borrowing their drugs, or you're getting them on the street. And once you start engaging in those risky behaviors, you should be able to recognize that you're no longer in control of your life with regard to your pain control.
So we have, in 2015, opioids were involved in more than 33,000 deaths nationwide, and opioid overdoses have quadrupled since 1999. This is information from the Attorney General's offices of Georgia. 55 Georgia counties have overdose rates higher than the national average. Mark, do we have an idea of why we're seeing such a spike in these addictions and deaths at this point in our history?
Well, we have some ideas, but I think it's important to get on the table that very few people who take opioids for pain actually become heroin addicts, actually start using street drugs. The percentage given by NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, is 4%. So only 4% of people who actually take prescription opioids go on to use drugs for recreational purposes. And that's really important. You know, it's like most people who dive start off swimming, but it isn't the case that everyone who swims ends up diving, right? So that's an important element. So I don't think the cause is actually in the drug. I don't think the drug takes hold of a person. I think that's kind of a magical sort of metaphor. Rather, I think it's the person's life, a sense of meaninglessness or emptiness, a sense of dislocation, loneliness, not knowing who you are or how to fit in with your community, with your friends, with your culture. I think those are really, really important factors.
Then let me take that to both Shannon and Chris as well, in terms of what's causing this spike in overdoses and why is what Mark's talking about? Why are those kind of distinctions important, Chris?
The spike in overdoses, in what I've read and doing some research on this, is the introduction of fentanyl and designer drug analogs similar to fentanyl into the marketplace. The drugs that typically we use to control pain medication are Percocet, Lortabs, these type things, and they have OxyContin and hydrocodone in them, which don't have near the potency. The introduction of black market fentanyl derivatives, to me, seems to have heralded the increased number of overdoses in the last 2 years. These are not drugs that were originally prescribed to patients for pain control. You know, fentanyl has been around since the 60s as an adjunct to anesthesia. We do use it in like spinal epidurals and certain pain control, but it's all under the supervision of a physician, typically in a hospital setting. Later it became, they put it on patches for pain control in patients with terminal disease such as cancer to control their pain. These drugs being introduced into the street have resulted in the increased number of overdoses that you see.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with River Edge Behavioral Health Center CEO Shannon Gordon, also Navicent Health Chief Medical Officer Chris Hendry, who you just heard, and neuroscientist Mark Lewis. This discussion we're having at this moment is a little bit problematic because it appears that law enforcement, at least, is focused on prescriptions. So we got this message from Attorney General Chris Carr of Georgia, who says from June 2016 to May of 2017, the total number of legal opioid doses prescribed to Georgia patients surpassed 541 million, and we are losing far too many citizens as a result of drug overdose doses. And then he pledges to work on behalf of the people of Georgia to stop this. But Shannon, where should attention be focused, on prescriptions or on street medication?
On prescription. In 2009, opioid prescriptions were the most abused drug by young adults, according to the National Institute of Drug Abuse. And so that's where I would put my focus.
Then let's take this to the broader subject here, which is how we treat opioid addiction or addiction in the medical community and as a society, because there is sometimes an argument, especially among policymakers, about whether to treat addiction, like drug addiction like this, as a moral failing, a weakness in your character, or as a disease. We went out and asked people here in Atlanta what they thought, and here's the first person.
My name is Howard Connolly. I live here in Atlanta, Grant Park area. I think it starts off as a moral and turns into a medical, because sometimes a person's environment, stress levels, things of that nature might turn them towards what they might deem as a way to relax and get away from it, and that creates the addiction. And then you have to treat an addiction through medical resources.
Mark, what do you make of this question?
Well, I don't see addiction as a disease, but I do see it as a very powerful habit that becomes deeply ingrained. I think we have to look at what's in the drug, what the drug is doing for the person. And opioids are being received by brain systems that are in charge of reducing stress, as Shannon said, but also reducing pain, reducing a sense of panic. So why are people going around feeling so stressed and so panicked and so alone that they might want to take large doses of opioids? And by the way, it's not correct to go after the prescription opioids per se, because it's, as Chris said, it's fentanyl. It's street fentanyl. It's killing people. And that's, you know, that's a whole different matter. But, you know, we have to ask deeper questions rather than just who should we go after, or whether it's a disease or not.
Well, but this, whether to treat it as a disease is a question that's going on in terms of where to put money. So let me put this to you, Shannon. Here's another comment from someone that we spoke to.
I'm Jasmine Brookings from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm going to say a moral problem. Simply because, you know, growing up in a black community, we go through more problems than the Caucasians go through. So, you know, we're more affected by the drug use.
Shannon, how much does this particular question affect our treatment of someone with an addiction?
I see the issue of it's being perceived as a moral issue as a tremendous barrier to seeking treatment because of the shame that's associated with addiction, because so many do continue to see it as a moral failing. But people move into addiction when they use compulsively, when they experience cravings, when they continue to use despite negative consequences, and when they've developed physical tolerance that results in withdrawal when the chemical is stopped. And that is medical.
All right, so let's hear one more comment from someone here in Atlanta.
My name is David Traeger. I live up in Duluth, Georgia. I think it's a little bit of both. As far as medically, I think that there's something in your brain that just doesn't allow you to stop that addiction, you know. And then as far as like morally, you kind of know it's wrong. Like I smoke, and I know it's wrong, but it's just very difficult for me to stop.
So, Chris, is it fair to make the comparison between an addiction to painkillers to something like smoking or a more common addiction?
Yes, absolutely. The physical changes the body undergoes after their exposure to opioid drugs are, in some cases, the first dose can rewire how your nervous system works, which is why patients who detox off of heroin or other opioid-type medications that act on the opioid pain receptors, often this has to be done in a supervised situation. The patients can have confusion, seizures, nausea, vomiting, dehydration, hallucinations. These are signs of a physical removal of the chemical that they become dependent on, the same as nicotine.
So, Mark, where in this process, as somebody moves from being treated with painkillers, maybe post-surgical or something like that, and possibly down the road toward addiction. Where's the best point for intervention?
Yeah, we're conflating two things here. One is physical dependency, chemical dependency, which is what Chris described. And the other is the psychological elements of addiction, which are much more serious. When people really get addicted to something, they often stop and stay off for a while and then come back to it a few months later, a few years later. And it's the continuing relapsing, which is a psychological issue, because by then the drug is nowhere. It's been out of your body for a very long time. These psychological changes have to do with habits of thinking, I need to take this to feel better. And that's the habit that needs to be changed. And I don't think we have the tools to change it from a medical perspective. Medicine is great for dealing with withdrawal symptoms and overdoses and stuff like that for the drugs that do become physically, that do create physical dependencies like opioids. But cocaine, for example, there's no physical dependency. Gambling is known to be an addiction, is defined as an addiction, but obviously there's no chemical dependency. So I don't think medicine is actually well equipped to deal with the psychological changes that need to happen for people to get better.
So Shannon, this is quite literally your business. What do you make of that?
I would concur with Mark that it is a biopsychosocial and physical phenomena that needs holistic approach.
You know, it's interesting that you brought up gambling. When you look at behavioral conditioning, random positive reinforcement is the strongest behavioral modification that you can do. And that's what you see with gambling and slot machines, because it's this random payout. And the reinforcement in your behavior is dramatic.
Well, then how does that look in terms of treatment? How do you then treat that?
Well, most when you talk to heroin addicts, they'll tell you after that first high, they're constantly chasing that first high. And it's never as good as their first dose. I'm sure Shannon can speak better to that than I can in working with.
Okay, Shannon.
Again, it is a biopsychosocial phenomena, and the most effective treatments address thinking, feeling, behavior, and the physical components.
As long as we can save their life, right? I mean, we started off right. This whole thing talking about overdoses, which are deadly. So Mark, how serious should we be taking this? In other words, is the medical community and the political community that makes policy and determines where money goes, are they taking it as seriously as warranted?
Yeah, well, they're taking it seriously, but they're making a lot of really bad decisions. I mean, the policy of going after this person or that person, the doctors or the dealers, it's just not going to work. You go after one dealer, another one's going to pop up, or 10 more are going to pop up. The idea of restricting the availability of opioid drugs for people who are addicted is just dead wrong, because if you restrict their availability, they will definitely go to the street to get their to get what they need, and they have a much greater likelihood of overdosing. So we need to supply drugs like naloxone, which act directly against the effect of the opioid on breathing and on everything else. So that should be available just about everywhere. That's the only way to stop an OD as it's happening. And we should be making methadone and suboxone available. Those are opioids that are given to people with known addictions who need to take opioids for one reason or another. And restricting those drugs is just going to push them closer to the grave.
That is writer and neuroscientist Mark Lewis. We also spoke with Shannon Gordon, CEO of River Edge Behavioral Health Center, and Chris Hendry is chief medical officer at Navicent Health. Thank you so much to all of you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
That's it for today. But what do you make of the question, should addiction be classified as disease or something that's under your control? You can find us on Facebook or tweet us at OST Talk. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.